15. A new confession. At 11 the following morning, a driver dropped Poirot off at the gates of Little Quay. He had telephoned at 8 to alert me to his likely arrival time, and I was waiting for him. "All is as I expected it to be, mon ami," he said. "My investigations have been fruitful. Every one of my suspicions has been confirmed. Godfrey LaViolette's financial situation is more than satisfactory. His banker tells me that it has always been so. As for our Joan Blythe from the Kingfisher coach, I had a most enlightening conversation with her mother. The green hat and coat were brand new, as I knew they would be. They had not been worn before the day that you and I first saw her wearing them. Ah, I see you wonder why this is important. Soon you will see." Poirot handed me his suitcase and started a walk towards the house. I hurried after him. "I spent a delightful hour with the publisher of Midnight Gathering," he went on. "He was able to furnish me with essential information about the other Joan Blythe, the writer of the book. Most helpful of all was the former doctor to the deceased Otto Proud, Dr. F. Grave, to whom I spoke at length. What he told me was the ice upon the cake. Alors, all is in hand. Tomorrow, Sergeant Gidley will arrive, and he will bring with him Ellen Acton. Then we will clear up once and for all the perplexing affair of the killings at Kingfisher Hill. Now, tell me, Catchpool, how have you fared in my absence? Wait, not now. Anyone might overhear us." This was true. We were by now standing in the entrance hall of Little Quay. "I shall unpack my things, and then we will talk." An hour later, we were seated in the library, awaiting Daisy Devonport. I had given Poirot the fine detail of all the conversations I had conducted in his absence, ending with the most dramatic one, and Daisy's insistence that she must speak to him immediately. "Ah, c'est parfait," he cried. "You will see, my friend, the conversation that we are about to have with Mademoiselle Daisy, this too will unfold exactly as I predict. If I had a pen and paper, I could write it down like the lines of a play. It is almost as if I am able to observe the future." He really was pleased with himself today. When Daisy entered the library, it was clear that she had been crying, and recently. Her eyes were red and swollen. "Thank goodness you're back," she said to Poirot, lowering herself into the nearest chair to his. "How may I help you?" he asked her. "I pray that you can. I've been so awfully foolish, Monsieur Poirot. Mademoiselle, I wonder, will you permit me to tell you, and Catchpool here, the story that you wish to tell me?" Daisy looked confused. "You do not know the story, only I know it." "Do not be so sure," said Poirot. "You may stop me if I get something wrong. Do you agree?" Still looking nonplussed, she nodded. "You are here, are you not, to make a new confession? Not to the crime of murder this time, however. This morning you wish to confess to a lesser sin, the sin of lying. You have told a very serious lie, have you not?"
"Yes."
Tears spilled over and ran down Daisy's face. "And as if that were not enough, you have heinously contrived to conceal from me and from Inspector Catchpool many important things. Is this not so?" She nodded. "You did not murder your brother Frank, did you?"
"No, I did not."
"What about the lady in the green hat and coat? Did you kill her?"
"No,"
said Daisy.
"I have killed nobody, but silence, please.
Allow me to tell you what you did. You took the poker from the fireplace and destroyed the head and face of the dead woman. You bludgeoned her until you were certain that she would not be recognized. Yes?"
"Yes,"
Daisy whispered. "And the note written in black ink. You sat in a seat you should never have sat in. Now here comes a poker to batter your hat in.
I wrote the note and placed it on her body, said Daisy.
Indeed. Poirot's eyes moved around the room as he deliberated. This is fascinating. Fascinating. You wrote the note because at the same time you did and did not wish to reveal the dead woman's identity. Daisy looked at him.
You are extremely clever, Monsieur Poirot. I am no match for you.
Poirot paused, apparently savoring her words. Tell me, if you did not kill the woman in the green hat and coat, then who did?
I don't know. Truly, I don't. It might have been anyone. Anyone apart from Oliver or me. We were out walking together between 10 and 11, but everyone else, even those who were supposed to be with somebody at the time... I mean, it's not impossible for two people to have done it together, is it?
No, it is not, Poirot agreed. Let us talk about the dead woman, the woman from the coach. She gave her name as Joan Blythe. Does that name sound familiar to you?
Yes, said Daisy. That is one of the things I wanted to tell you, Monsieur Poirot. I have withheld so much and told so many lies. I wish I could say that I am sorry.
It feels true.
I am sorry now. But if I were not in a state of mortal fear, would I be sorry? I doubt it. Which means that you should scorn my apparent contrition. It means that I regret my dishonesty for my own sake, not for any other nobler reason.
She looked very young and afraid, and I tried hard not to feel sorry for her. For all I knew, this was just another act. Poirot said, All I seek is the truth of what happened, mademoiselle. The rest is a matter for your conscience. She nodded. Gathering herself a little, she said,
Joan Blythe is the name of the author of a book that is very dear to me. Midnight Gathering. I had it with me on the coach. You saw it, Inspector Catchpole, do you remember? I'd put it down on the seat beside me, and I turned and found you staring at it rather oddly. Then later you accused me of having stolen it, Monsieur Poirot, when I had done no such thing. For some reason, the book caused you both to behave in a most peculiar way. In any case, Joan Blythe, the real Joan Blythe, whoever she might be, is that novel's author. It was given to me by a friend of mine, a man called Humphrey. I subsequently gave it as a gift to many other people.
Why did you not tell me the truth on the coach when I asked how the book came into your possession? Said Poirot. And why did you tell me that you had invented Humphrey? I asked her.
I did tell you the truth, Daisy said to Poirot. I told you it was a present someone had given me. I was about to say that it was from a friend called Humphrey when I realized that you had just accused me of theft and did not deserve to know any more than I had already told you.
It hardly mattered to you. It could have been Humphrey, Cedric, or James, for all you would care. She turned to me.
I told you the truth at first, too. Then I decided to have some fun and take it back, pretend it was a lie. I quite enjoy lying sometimes. It's good sport.
This I have no difficulty in believing, Poirot said with a small sigh. Did you enjoy pretending to have murdered your brother, Frank?
That provided me with a darker sort of satisfaction, said Daisy. I would not describe it as enjoyment.
And you believed you were safe from punishment for this crime to which you had confessed? For as long as Ellen Acton adhered to her story that she killed Frank, you were safe. She was already in prison and condemned to die. You were at no risk of being hanged for a crime of which another woman had already been convicted?
So I thought,
Daisy said quietly. Then when Catchpole told you that Helen Acton had retracted her confession, you panicked. You could not allow your own confession to be the only one. Here, suddenly, was a tangible danger that you might be the one to hang.
You are very clever, Monsieur Poirot.
You understand why I'm now willing to tell you the truth.
Allow me to return the favor, mademoiselle.
What do you mean?
I also will now tell you the truth. Ellen Acton has not retracted her confession. That was our little lie that we devised for you.
Daisy's mouth fell open. She stared at me hard.
Do not blame Inspector Catchpool, Poirot told her. The idea was mine. Now, tell me, do you wish to confess once more to the murder of Frank? If not, that leaves Helen Acton as the only one claiming to be guilty. Her execution will no doubt be expedited if you are no longer offering a rival confession for consideration.
But I don't want Helen to die. Daisy's voice shook. Frank loved her, and she loved him. I know she did. I saw it. Not for long, but I saw it. It was real. You could feel it in the room. But I do not want to tell any more lies. Not to save Helen, not for any reason. I'm tired of lying. So tired.
I knew what she meant. I rarely lied, but when I did, usually at Poirot's instigation or to pacify my mother, I found it exhausting.
I will ask you again to make sure, said Poirot. Did you kill your brother, Frank? Did you push him over the balcony to his death? No, I did not. I swear it. I have never murdered anyone. I only wanted you to think that I could and that I had. I see now how stupid and vain and petty I have been. There is nothing I can say that will make up for what I've done. I know that. My behavior has been inexcusable.
She shut her eyes and closed her hands into fists.
If you only knew how I have dreamed of committing murder and getting away with it. I have spent nearly a year wishing I could do it, ever since Father sent Frank away. But I am incapable. I am no better than a frightened child. So instead I boasted of doing the thing I was afraid to do. It might not make sense to you, but I only wanted to pretend to be someone who possessed the courage I lacked.
You wished to kill Frank? I asked her.
No, not at all.
Daisy stood up and walked over to the window.
I adored Frank, but having lost him forever, it won't make sense to you, I'm sure, but after his death, I fantasized endlessly that it was I who had killed him to punish Father and Mother. If they thought they could have him back after they had deprived me of him.
Her face contorted in pain.
And then sometimes it was my parents I dreamed of murdering, the people who cared so little for my feelings that they disowned my brother, even though I begged them not to. Oh, we all knew the hierarchy of importance. Father at the top, above everybody, then Mother, then Frank. Richard and I were irrelevant. Mother could have made Father see sense if she'd only been brave enough to stand up to him. Look what happened when she fell ill and asked if Frank could be forgiven. He granted her wish.
Mademoiselle, if you did not push Frank to his death, then who did? Daisy shook her head.
I wish I knew. When I came out of my room, he was already falling.
And you saw people standing on the landing near where he had fallen, did you not? Whom did you see?
Helen, Verna, Mother and Father.
Daisy turned to me.
May I answer your other questions now, Inspector? The ones I would not answer when you asked me yesterday. I should like to atone for my dishonesty by being as truthful as I can from now on. I did tell you the truth about one thing. You asked me why Father and Mother sent us all over to Kingfisher's View on the day Frank was killed. I gave you an honest answer. They simply wanted it. In their estimation, in the ordinary course of things, only they and their wishes matter. On that particular day, Frank mattered too, but none of the rest of us ever had, so why on earth would they want us cluttering up the house? There was nothing more to it than that.
This was a fuller answer than she had given me the first time. I believed her.
You also asked why Father tolerated Richard's engagement to Helen. It's quite simple. After Frank's murder, my parents decided to pretend that neither Frank nor Helen had ever existed. Not straight away, mind you. They screamed and wailed over Frank's lifeless body for about 30 minutes, after which they closeted themselves away in Mother's bedroom. When they eventually emerged from that room, we all saw at once that a sort of wall had gone up around them. From that moment, until the two of you arrived and started asking uncomfortable questions, they behaved as if they had never had a son called Frank, and as if there was no such person as Helen. "And so when Richard proposed marriage to her and she accepted?" Poirot prompted. Richard saw that in this particular matter Father was powerless. News of the engagement reached him, of course, but he has never acknowledged it. We all knew that he wouldn't. In order to protest about it, he would have had to utter Helen's name, which might have led to a conversation that would have been impossible for his pride to withstand. Richard could have said, "Who are you to tell me what to do, Father? You said Frank was to be banished forever, then changed your mind on a whim to please Mother." Obviously, Richard would never be so bold, but the possibility was there, and that was enough to ensure Father's silence on the subject. He knew only too well that changing his mind about Frank had diminished his moral authority beyond repair. And he and Mother were very quickly unwilling to think about Frank at all. They did not want to be bereaved or to have had a son who had stolen from them, a son who was then murdered. They created a new reality that they could stand to live in, one in which nothing had happened, none of the unbearable, shameful things. How could they then object to Richard's engagement without stepping out of their invented world and into our real one? "What about your engagement to Oliver Proud?" I asked her. "Did you think along the same lines as Richard? That Sydney would disapprove of your marriage to Oliver, yet be unable to object?" "Yes, I did. What could he have said? I forbid you to marry the man who conspired with Frank to steal from me." I would have feigned innocence and said, "But Father, I don't understand. If Frank can be given another chance, then why not Oliver? You said that we must never weaken and allow Frank to worm his way back in." Don't you see? Father had succumbed to persuasion from Mother to make her last days more bearable, but he loathed himself for doing it. He saw it as unpardonable weakness on his part, and took pains to ensure that Richard and I would have no occasion to raise the subject for discussion. "Do you love Oliver Proud?" Poirot asked her. "Of course I do. Not as much as he loves me, but I would never wish to love a husband that much. One would feel rather powerless." "I have another question for you, Mademoiselle. When you came into the drawing room and found me there with Inspector Catchpool, Sergeant Gidley, and the police doctor, do you recall the scene?" "Yes. That woman's dead body was there, lying on the floor, and I was about to have to pretend that I had not recently smashed up her head with a poker. Of course I recall it. I shall never forget it." "Then you may also recall that Catchpool and I discussed her identity. The name Joan Blythe was mentioned. Why did you not immediately say, 'This is a coincidence, for Joan Blythe is also the author of my favourite book?'" Daisy smiled sadly. "Because midnight gathering at that point was the very furthest thing from my mind. I knew Joan Blythe wasn't the dead woman's name, and I knew why she had told you it was." Poirot was nodding as she spoke. "You knew, did you not, that her real name was Winnie Lord?" said Daisy. I wished I could see through the skin of his forehead to the fine mind beneath. How had he known that Joan Blythe and Winnie Lord were one and the same person? It was unfathomable to me. "Let us play a little game," Poirot said to Daisy Devonport. "I will tell you parts of a story, the parts that I know. It will be like the jigsaw puzzle. You will fill in the missing pieces. Do you agree?" She nodded. "I have known for certain, only since yesterday, that John Blythe from the motor coach was Winnie Lord, though I guessed it much earlier. There was something I knew almost from the start, something that helped me greatly. I knew that you and Joan Blythe from the coach were travelling together. You were not two passengers who happened to be seated for some minutes side by side. You were travelling companions. Knowing as I did that the two of you had embarked upon this journey by motor coach together, and yet ended up pretending, for my benefit, to be strangers to one another, this has made the solving of all of the puzzles seem possible to me from the very beginning, when it did not seem possible to Catchpole. For him, there were only the many strands that made no sense when each was viewed as unconnected to the others. He remarked upon the impossible coincidence of them all happening at once. First, a woman warned by a stranger that she would be murdered if she sat in a particular seat, then that seat being next to one occupied by a woman who tells Hercule Poirot that she has committed murder herself. How can it happen, Catchpole asked me, that two women speak to us so candidly of murder during the same journey? Two unconnected women. Or so he believed. Eh bien, then there was the apparent coincidence, le plus incroyable, that these two revelations should occur while we are en route to Kingfisher Hill to investigate yet another murder for which an innocent woman might be about to hang. Of course, mademoiselle, there was nothing coincidental about any of it. As you know, you, the inspired inventor who orchestrated the entire scene. You and Winnie Lord were travelling to Kingfisher Hill. It was where you both lived. You had been to London, and now you were returning. You did not know that your brother Richard had asked for my help in proving Helen Acton's innocence. He had told no one. When you became aware that here was Hercule Poirot, the famous detective, within easy reach, it did not strike you as anything but a coincidence. An opportunity. You had no notion that I was en route to Little Quay to solve the murder of Frank Devonport. According to the law, that crime was already solved, and justice was soon to be done. You, meanwhile, had spent many months indulging in the morbid fantasy that you had committed the murder of Frank in order to punish your parents, to deprive them of him in the very same way that they had deprived you. Alors, you decided to play a little game with Poirot, the part of you that liked to tell lies in order to create certain effects it could not resist. It did not try, Daisy admitted. I was certain I could confess to you without letting slip any details that would identify me. I was excited to hear what you might have to say on the matter. I yearned for you to solve the mystery and guess why I did it, which you failed to do. I didn't kill Frank, but if I had, well, I would have had a very interesting and clever motive, wouldn't I? I thought to myself, let's see if the great Hercule Poirot can work it out. Ah, but you faced an obstacle, said Poirot. How could you make this confession to me? I was sitting next to Catchpole, several rows behind you, and you were sitting in the seventh row with Winnie Lord. You could hardly stand and shout about murder over the heads of all the other passengers. How did you know that Winnie and I were travelling together? Said Daisy. It was obvious, said Poirot. Catchpole had seen a book on the seat beside you, Midnight Gathering. When you saw him looking at it, you picked it up and held it for a moment. Then, when Catchpole started to move along down the aisle, you put the book back on that seat, the one that was later taken by Winnie Lord. But the coach was full, completely full. And you knew that, mademoiselle, because Alfred Bixby, owner of the Kingfisher Coach Company, had boasted most volubly and made sure we passengers all knew that every ticket was sold and every seat taken. You notice everything, don't you? Said Daisy. But Catchpole does not yet comprehend, said Poirot. When I finally sat beside you, mademoiselle, you told me that you would not have been surprised if Monsieur Bixby had employed actors to give a false impression of the coach being full. When you said that, I knew at once You were as aware as I of the fullness of the coach. You knew that every seat would be taken by somebody eventually. There was no chance that the one next to you would remain unoccupied. Why, then, I asked myself, would you leave your book on it so that no one could sit down when there were people boarding the vehicle at this exact moment? Sooner or later, you would have had to move the book and accept a neighbor for the journey. So why would you not do so immediately? There seemed only one possible answer. You were saving that seat for a particular person, Winnie Lord. But the two of them were not together, I said, confused. Joan, Winnie, was standing alone. You, Miss Devonport, were standing some distance away and making loud, unpleasant remarks about her for all to hear, as if she were a stranger for whom you had nothing but disdain. I was angry, said Daisy. Winnie and I had been together until she behaved in a way that disappointed me greatly. That was when she ran away from me and started to behave like a gibbering fool. I hoped, by speaking so harshly, I might bring her to her senses, remind her that she and I were friends and that she owed me a certain loyalty. I had always been good to her. The green hat and coat she was wearing were gifts from me, and they were not inexpensive. What made her run away from you? Said Poirot. Wait, I think I know the answer. Remember, Ketchpool, that when you first spoke to Winnie Lord and introduced yourself as an inspector from Scotland Yard, she replied that you could not be a police inspector, that it was impossible. She demanded to know your true identity. This provides the clue to what must have taken place between her and Mademoiselle Daisy only minutes before, leaving her so shocked and afraid and making you, Mademoiselle, so angry. You frequently find yourself feeling disproportionately angry, do you not? You experience the wild rage that can barely be contained when there has been only the mildest provocations. Daisy closed her eyes. Poirot said, on the coach, when Ketchpool here merely glanced at your book, you reacted with disproportionate aggression, as you did when you spoke so savagely of Winnie Lord in front of the other passengers. When I first sat next to you, you expressed hostility towards me. Generally, mademoiselle, you were full of the rage that had no obvious cause. This is how a person behaves when they have suppressed their natural anger, caused by an oppressive parent in this instant and the forced disavowal of a beloved brother for far too long. Monsieur Poirot, may I tell you something? Daisy leaned forward. Please. When I saw that I would have to smash up Winnie's head and face so that no one would recognize her, I rather relished the prospect. She was dead already, with the poker lying beside her and some blood under her head, and, well, I worked up a considerable sweat while doing it. I felt calm and peaceful afterwards, as if the anger that had been boiling in me for so long had drained away. You must also have been angry with Frank, said Poirot. Your parents had caused you the greatest unhappiness by forcing the two of you apart, yet Frank was ready to forgive them and seemed to return with no bitterness in his heart. Did you not feel betrayed by him? Daisy smiled. Goodness me, you really are as clever as people say you are. And you are a highly imaginative young woman. When I first met you, I accused you of making too much of a fuss about murder, said Daisy. That is not my true opinion. Murder is a terrible thing, the most terrible of all. I wish... She gasped suddenly. I wish that Frank were still alive. I wish it with all my heart. Yes, I see that it is so, Poirot said gently. When he was killed, you were grief-stricken, more full of rage than ever. You wanted to make others suffer as you suffered. You asked yourself, what would be the cruelest possible punishment that you could inflict upon Sidney and Lillian Devonport? A clever and devious plan occurred to you. When did you think of it? long before you first encountered Hercule Poirot by the side of a motor coach, I think. It was very soon after Frank died, said Daisy. I heard Helen tell the police that she had already pushed him over the balcony by the time anybody else appeared on the landing. And I saw with my own eyes that all Mother and Father saw was Frank falling to his death. They did not notice me at all, though I was there too, standing between them and Helen. They couldn't have been sure that it was not I who pushed Frank. Eh bien, you had the idea that was at once outrageous and all too easy to put into action, said Poirot. What if you were to pretend that you were the killer, and that your motive for murdering your brother was the belief instilled in you by your parents' determined indoctrination that Frank was a danger to the family? Why, then Sidney and Lily and Devonport would be forced to confront an intolerable realization that they had lost the son they had only just regained, and that it was entirely their own fault, and a direct result of their unwillingness to allow you to have your own thoughts and feelings about Frank. Such effort had they put into making you believe he was a danger, and now, when they have relented and want only to reclaim their banished, lost son, now they must pay the price for having so brainwashed you against him. Yes. It was the perfect reversal, said Daisy. When I wanted to keep Frank, they wouldn't allow it. Then, when they wanted to keep him, I wouldn't allow it. And for the very same reason, because now I was the one to believe him to be a terrible danger, and I only believed that because they had made me believe it. It makes for a marvelous story, don't you think, Monsieur Poirot? How much of this perfect reversal story did you tell to Winnie Lord? Said Poirot. That is why she was in such a state of distress, yes? You saw Poirot and decided that you must play your game with him, confess to this murder you had not committed, and so why not practice by first telling the tale to Winnie? I needed something to keep me entertained, said Daisy. Alfred Bixby was taking an age to open the doors of the coach, and I was freezing to death. That must be why Winnie responded so strangely when I introduced myself as a police inspector, I said. Indeed, said Poirot. Winnie Lord was, at that very moment, considering whether to go to the police with this new information she had just received. Then, suddenly, a representative of Scotland Yard appeared beside her. It must all have seemed so incroyable to her as to make her wonder. Could all of this be a joke played by her friend Daisy Devonport? First the confession, and so soon afterwards the policeman? Winnie turned out to be no friend of mine, Daisy said bitterly. I thought she would stand by me no matter what, but she proved to be a disloyal piece of work if ever there was one. She threatened to tell the police, even though I had just taken her up to London and bought her a beautiful new hat and coat. I had to offer her a sizable amount of money to secure her silence. I knew she and her mother were in desperate need of it. Mademoiselle, tell me, what precisely did you say to Winnie Lord about why you had killed Frank? Before we had boarded the coach? Nothing at all. Only that I had done it and Helen was innocent. Afterwards, when I found her weeping by the side of a road near the Tartar Inn at Cobham, I told her a lot more. I said that... Well, first I told her everything that I had told you. And then? She was by turns sullen and hysterical, Daisy said impatiently. She kept asking how I could let Helen Acton hang for a crime I had committed. Had I not just told her that I had confessed, and to none other than Hercule Poirot? Silly fool. She really was tedious about it. At that point, I couldn't resist telling her the whole story of why I had murdered Frank, though, of course, I had done no such thing, but anything to relieve the boredom of having to deal with her. So you told Winnie Lord only then, at Cobham, that your true reason for killing Frank was not that you believed him to be evil and dangerous, but instead that you wished your parents to think you had done it for this reason and to believe that their earlier indoctrination of you against your brother had caused the tragedy.
Exactly, yes, said Daisy with a slight smile. So that they would have to live with the knowledge of their own culpability. I told Winnie that I was only going to admit to my false motive, you see, saving my family from the evil and dangerous Frank. My perfect revenge only worked if they thought I'd done it because of what they had made me believe about Frank.
I see, said Poirot. So if that was your false motive, then your other one, your perfect revenge motive, as you call it, would you describe that as your true motive, even though you did not commit the murder?
Daisy nodded.
It was true. A motive can be true even if one has not acted upon it.
Fascinating, Poirot murmured.
I had hoped that Winnie would be interested in discussing everything that was brilliant about my plan, the structural exquisiteness of it. But instead she only whined about how unpardonable it was that I had allowed the police to believe a different story for so long and risked Helen Acton's life. Oh, she was a fool. Do I sound despicable, Monsieur Poirot? Perhaps I am. But Winnie knew as well as I did that Helen wanted to take the blame, or else she would not have done so. She could easily have said that Frank fell. Who would have thought of murder if she had only said it was an accident? Helen wanted to die. She still does. But Winnie was too stupid to see that.
Poirot nodded. He said, Let us hear now about the other story you invented, the one that had not been created in your mind months in advance, but was rather an improvisation on the day of our journey by coach.
What do you mean?
Daisy looked puzzled. The mysterious stranger with his warning of murder, said Poirot. The seat in the seventh row beside the aisle on the right.
Oh, that.
Oui, mademoiselle, that.
As you say, it was an on-the-spot improvisation.
Hold on a minute, I said. Are you suggesting that...
Yes, Catchpole, said Poirot.
The story told to us by Winnie Lord was preposterous, sensational nonsense from start to finish. There was not a grain of truth in it. It was invented by Mademoiselle Daisy with the sole aim of arranging for me to sit next to her so that she could make to me her murder confession.
My face must have made for a gruesome picture at this point in the proceedings. To think that I had listened so carefully to Winnie's lies and wasted hours since that day trying to make sense of the large helping of codswallop she had fed us.
And Winnie agreed to tell this ridiculous tale at your behest when she believed you to be a murderer? I asked Daisy. No wonder she could barely bring herself to board the coach and sit beside you after what you had told her.
I have already told you. I offered her a large sum of money to do as I asked. I bought her unquestioning compliance, just as Father had always bought Mother's and mine and Richard's.
Daisy frowned.
But I'm not a tyrant like Father. I was always good to Winnie. I cared for her. When I told her I had killed Frank, I expected her to be shocked, naturally. But there was no need for her to walk away from me as if I had a contagious disease. If she had made a similar confession to me, I would have asked her why, first of all. I'd have done my best to understand her predicament. And... Well, I hadn't committed a murder, so it felt rather unfair to be ostracized when I knew I was innocent.
Seeing my expression, Daisy said sharply, You do not need to point out to me the flaw in my reasoning, Inspector Catchpole. I'm well aware of it.
Do you want the whole truth, or do you not?
Our true thoughts are often profoundly irrational.
Did you tell Winnie Lord to pretend that her name was Joan Blythe? Asked Poirot.
No. That was the one thing I didn't think of, a name for her. She must have thought of the book and decided that the name of its author would do. Midnight Gathering would have been at the forefront of her mind because...
Please, allow me,
Poirot interrupted.
May I tell this part of the story?
Very well. Daisy eyed him doubtfully.
Catchpole.
He turned to me.
Remind us of what Mademoiselle Daisy told me when I asked her where she had obtained the book.
She said it was originally a gift from, then stopped and would not say the rest.
The word originally is most informative, said Poirot. When one is given a gift that one keeps, and we know that you still had the book in your possession, Mademoiselle, one has no need to say the word originally. One would use that word only if the book, at the time of asking, was no longer the gift that it once was, that it had originally been. Do you see, Catchpole?
No, I don't see at all, I said.
Think about it, mon ami. If the book was given to Daisy Devonport by her friend, Humphrey, and she still had it, as we know she did, then it remained a gift from Humphrey. There would be no need to use the word originally. If, however, it had at one time been a gift from Mademoiselle Daisy to Winnie Lord, a gift that Winnie had very recently returned as a gesture of disgust and defiance after Mademoiselle Daisy confessed to the murder of Frank Devonport.
Are you saying that the book was a present from Daisy to Winnie Lord, and then Winnie gave it back to her? I said.
I believe this is so, yes.
He is quite right, said Daisy.
Winnie loved that book, carried it with her wherever she went. I'd written a special message inside it for her, and it meant the world to her. Soon after I told her that I'd killed Frank, the driver of the coach came to take our suitcases and bags to stow them away. Winnie made him wait while she removed Midnight Gathering from her case. She handed it back to me and said, I don't want this anymore, you can have it back. So yes, it was, originally, a gift from me to Winnie, one she later rejected. That is why I had it with me on the coach. I would hardly have...
Daisy stopped abruptly. A red hue crept across her face.
You would hardly have wanted or needed to read Midnight Gathering yourself,
Poirot finished her sentence for her.
You knew every word in its pages and every episode in its narrative almost by heart. Because you... Daisy Devonport, under the name Joan Blythe, are the book's author. Please, you mustn't tell a soul.
Daisy's face had turned white.
I know I have no right to ask it of you, but I beg of you.
How did you know, Poirot? I said incredulously.
A little guesswork, followed by the calculation of probabilities.
He looked at Daisy.
Why? I wondered, was this one novel of particular importance to you, you who have such a vivid imagination, such a skill for making up sensational and irresistible stories, and you who also, if you will pardon me, care so much more for your own inventions and what goes on in your own mind than for the truth or what might matter to anybody else? Why would you give this book to everyone who matters to you?
My suspicion was confirmed when I visited a publisher in London yesterday, a Mr. Humphrey Pluckrose of Pluckrose and Prince. You were not altogether lying, Mademoiselle, when you said that Humphrey Pluckrose had given you the book. It was not a gift, however. You had signed a contract with his firm that obliged him to furnish you with copies of your own novel.
Please keep this knowledge to yourself, begged Daisy. My writing is the only part of my life that my family knows nothing about and has no involvement in. It is my freedom.
I thought of Winnie Lord's fear when I uttered the words Midnight Gathering. When she heard me say it, she must have thought that the jig was up, that I'd seen her take the book out of her suitcase and hand it to Daisy. If I had, I would have known that they were not strangers to one another. When I explained that the woman who had been sitting beside her in the seventh row had a book with that title, her fear dissolved. It was then clear to her that I knew nothing of her personal connection to Midnight Gathering or to Daisy Devonport.
Will you keep my secret? Said Daisy. Please, Monsieur Poirot, Inspector Catchpole,
It is of paramount importance to me that this should remain unknown. Nobody, apart from the employees of Pluckrose and Prince, knows that I am Joan Blythe.
Do you know what is of paramount importance to me?
Poirot said softly.
The truth about the two murders at Little Quay. You have told me so much of it, mademoiselle, but still not all of it.
Never mind. I shall tell the rest to you. As soon as Sergeant Gidley can fetch Helen Acton from Holloway Prison and bring her here.